Exploration with Dr. Mishu Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to bring on two very special guests who'll talk about the future of space travel, astronomy, and also the future of medicine. Our first special guest is our friend Ken Croswell of Berkeley, and he'll be talking about water on the moon and the exploration of the universe. And then the second special guest in the second half hour is Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He's the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he'll be giving us some insights into the future of medicine. But let me also say, however, that today, people are being gripped by the news that we have not one, not two, but a triple whammy of nuclear threats. Nuclear threats, two of them in Nebraska, because we have knee-deep flooding at the Fort Calhoun and also the Cooper Station nuclear power plant, and also at Los Alamos, the famous weapons laboratory, where we have a forest fire right on the doorstep of the nation's premier weapons lab. And we have about 30,000 55-gallon drum barrels containing low-level nuclear waste at the Los Alamos site. Well, what are we going to do if the people of America and the people of the world turn away from nuclear energy as a consequence of the Fukushima nuclear disaster and also all the problems that we face in the United States with our own nuclear power plants? Well, find out, because in my latest book, Physics of the Future, I have a whole chapter where I talk about energy for the future. How are we going to energize our machines? How will we propel ourselves into the future? What will the energy mix be in the coming decades? I should also point out that my book, Physics of the Future, is a New York Times bestseller, and it talks about all aspects of science in the future. Medicine, space travel, robotics, computers, and everything you need to know about the economy and jobs of the future, all contained in my latest book, Physics of the Future, now a New York Times bestseller. Well, once again, today we have two special guests. The first guest is Dr. Ken Croswell, who'll talk about the future of space travel and astronomy, and then Dr. Arthur Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania, talking about the future of medicine. Ken, recently, astronomers have discovered water on the moon. What does that mean? How much water is there on the moon anyway? And what does it mean for space travel?
Well, the moon is still a very dry place. But if there is some water on the moon, that raises the hope that we'll be able to send people there more easily. The reason, of course, we need water on the moon is because we human beings need water. So if we send astronauts to the moon, they're going to need water. And it would be a lot cheaper if we can just get the water from the moon rather than having to drag it, lug it all the way from the Earth to the moon. If you've ever carried a few gallons of water home from a store, you know how heavy water is. Now imagine carrying that same water from the Earth to the moon. So the L-Cross spacecraft, which crashed into the south part of Mars a year ago in October, did discover some water. It's not clear to me just how much water there is right now and whether it's going to actually help astronauts if we ever do return to the moon. Of course, it will be very expensive to return to the moon no matter what, so whether or not there is water up there. But if there is, in fact, sufficient water for the astronauts to live on, then it will certainly reduce the cost of the trip.
And some people say that the moon is a little bit wetter than the Sahara Desert. So we're not talking about a lot of water. But if
right.
there is water, some people say that maybe we can separate out the oxygen and hydrogen and use it for rocket fuel, perhaps a saving for future space missions by extracting rocket fuel from water. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's another. That would be another use for water if we find it on the moon. Again, the less we have to take with us to the moon, the cheaper the trip will be. I mean, you can imagine if you're traveling, you know, across the country, the less luggage you have to take with you, the easier your life would be. I mean, imagine a hotel that had everything you needed, so you didn't have to take anything with you. Likewise, the more the lunar hotel has for the astronauts waiting there, both in terms of water to drink and also water to use for rocket fuel, the better.
And some people have said that if we have a permanent base on the moon, well, the moon is quite radioactive because of solar flares and cosmic rays. Water is a shielding material. It can actually shield you a bit from solar flares and radiation. So that's another bonus, right?
Yes, yes. And certainly also you could build underground bunkers on the moon, and that would also protect you from those same phenomena.
And some people think that maybe we should go back to the moon, not necessarily as humans, but as robots. Now, the Chinese are going to go back to the moon as humans in 2025. That's their goal. And the Americans, not to be outdone, are thinking about putting a robot on the moon. But is this just a publicity stunt, just so that we don't turn out to be sore losers when the Chinese go back to the moon? Or do you think there's some real value putting robots, humanoid robots, on the moon?
Well, it would be a whole new thing to actually operate a robot on another world. We, of course, have operated the rovers on the planet Mars, but to operate an actual robot on the moon would be kind of interesting. I'm not sure it'd be worth the expense. I'd have to see what sort of science we would learn from it. But, you know, the moon, the nice thing about the moon is it's the closest celestial body, it's the easiest to reach, therefore the cheapest to reach. And so if you want to, you know, try out things that you might want to do at greater distances, the moon is a great place to try those things out.
Now, let's shift focus away from the moon and on to Mars. Some people say that the moon, well, we've been there, done that, what else is new? Let's go on to Mars. But the cost is enormous going to Mars. And some people, therefore, are saying, let's send our astronauts on a one-way trip to the red planet. They don't need to come back. They can die in the red planet. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, certainly Mars is a more interesting world than the moon is. Mars has a much more interesting history, and it's still, to this day, a more interesting planet. It's got volcanoes that erupt occasionally. When I say occasionally, I mean every few million years, so it's not like we're going to see an eruption anytime soon. There's ice, a lot of ice on Mars, and there's all sorts of fascinating geological things on Mars, for example, dried up ancient riverbeds, and there may be fossils of ancient life on Mars. So for all those reasons, Mars is a more interesting place than the moon. But as you point out, it's a lot more expensive to reach Mars than it is to reach the moon. And yes, I did hear about this idea of sending people on a one-way trip to Mars, the idea being that they would basically live off the land on Mars, that they would construct what they need to do to survive on Mars. I would never volunteer for such a trip myself, but I have no doubt that there are plenty of people who would. So I would question, though, whether NASA would really want to fund such a mission because of the moral questions it raises. Even if you have people who are eager to volunteer, and I'm sure you would, there are some big moral questions there.
Well, some people say that we should send astronauts to Mars in their 60s. Then they can spend the last waning years of their life on the red planet. But then the question is, how long can a human last on the red planet when the atmosphere is carbon dioxide, is really cold, and it's rather hostile? Do you think we can really live off the land on Mars? What are your thoughts?
I think it'd be extremely difficult. Mars is a very hostile planet. It's the best planet in the solar system aside from Earth, but it's still a really, really hostile planet. You look at all the other competition. I mean, there's really not any competition. Venus is far worse. It's got a really thick atmosphere, 93 times the surface pressure of the Earth. Extremely hot, 860 degrees Fahrenheit. The moon is essentially airless, likewise Mercury. Mars is the best planet in the solar system aside from the Earth, but it's still, as you point out, extremely hostile. Very cold. The air is very thin. The atmosphere is 95% carbon dioxide. And you know what you would live off of? Certainly, I presume the soil on Mars would have you'd have no problem growing things in that soil. The soil is quite iron-rich, magnesium-rich, so you probably have a lot of iron and magnesium in your diet. However, what are you going to do if you want any animal products, like, you know, milk or cheese or anything like that? I mean, you basically would be, I don't really see us transporting cows to Mars anytime soon. So the people living off on Mars would really have to grow their own food on Mars. That could be done. But, again, the environment is just extremely hostile. So, I would not want to volunteer for that trip, but I have no doubt that there are plenty of people who would.
Well, some people take an intermediate position and say that let's send astronauts on a one-way ticket to Mars. However, once they're there, they'll mine the permafrost for water, separate out the oxygen and the hydrogen, and use that as rocket fuel for the return mission. So they have to create their own return rocket for the return mission by creating rocket fuel. That's a little more humane, right?
Yes, if they have the prospect of actually getting back to Earth, that is. And again, it would be cheaper because the less you have to bring with you, the cheaper the mission will be. And also, you know, in the far future, people might want to terraform Mars to make it more livable, more habitable. And one of the first tasks would be to beef up that atmosphere. The atmosphere is less than 1% as thick as the Earth's atmosphere, and so you would want to start adding gases to that atmosphere. In particular, you'd want to add oxygen, so that we'd be able to actually breathe it. So there's essentially no oxygen in the Martian atmosphere. 95% of that thin atmosphere is carbon dioxide, which, of course, is the gas we get rid of when we breathe. So it's not a problem for plants, but it is a big problem for people.
Now, some people suggest, along the lines of terraforming, that perhaps we inject greenhouse gases, deliberately accelerate a greenhouse effect on Mars by injecting maybe methane into the atmosphere, and then maybe deflect comets. Comets would slowly orbit around Mars, decay, and burn up in the atmosphere, and comets are made out of water. So what are your thoughts about some of these schemes, which are, of course, maybe 100 years into the future?
Right. Yes, we are talking far into the future here. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, and it would be certainly nice to warm Mars up because it is just too cold. One reason it's too cold is simply it's 50% farther from the sun than the Earth is. But another reason is the atmosphere is so thin that the greenhouse effect on Mars raises the temperature only 10 degrees Fahrenheit versus the greenhouse effect here on Earth raises the temperature 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And methane is an especially potent greenhouse gas, much more potent than carbon dioxide. So adding that to the atmosphere would help warm things up. And then you also mentioned the possibility of deliberately crashing a comet into Mars to retrieve the ice. I'm not quite sure I understand the point of that, because there's actually plenty of ice on Mars, especially in the polar regions beneath the surface. So I think we already have plenty of ice and water in frozen form on Mars. I don't think we really need to add too much to the supply, at least in the early years.
And some people have advocated detonating nuclear bombs on the ice caps of Mars because, as you point out, there's plenty of water there. But we don't want the water to be radioactive, right?
Right. I think that would make it the planet even less hospitable than it is already. Yeah.
Okay. Now let's shift our focus to the sun. Some people are saying that the sun is beginning to act up, and perhaps the sunspot activity will peak around 2012, 2013. What are your thoughts about the sunspot cycle and the sun?
Well, the sun is obviously a very important thing to us on Earth. It's the thing that keeps the Earth warm. And it's been acting a little strangely lately. It's been the sunspot activity has been reduced compared to normal. Now, it does, it goes through this 11-year period during which the number of sunspots peaks and then we reach a minimum. We seem to be coming out of that minimum. And the reason the sunspot number is so important is because it actually affects, to a slight extent, the climate here on Earth. The more sunspots there are, the brighter the sun is and the warmer the Earth gets. And it looks like the predictions are for the upcoming solar maximum, which will probably be in 2013 or thereabouts, looks like it's going to be a rather weak maximum. In other words, we may not see the normal number of sunspots that we typically have during past solar maxima. And that would correlate then with expecting a cooler climate on Earth for the next few years. In other words, we're not going to get the benefit of the extra warmth of those sunspots that we normally do.
Now, back in 1859, there was a gigantic solar storm that, if it happened today, it would wipe out most of our satellites, wipe out power stations, and the American Physical Society, my organization, even estimated the property damage could be up to $2 trillion, as most of the economy of North America is paralyzed. But these are very rare, right? We're not talking about 1859 events happening every day, right?
That's right. But they are more likely to occur when there are more sunspots on the sun. But again, this upcoming solar maxima is expected to be kind of on the weak side. So we may not see, in fact, we probably will not see those devastating solar storms that you would have seen, for example, in 1859.
Okay. And now let's talk about the latest issue of National Geographic magazine, which I have here. You have an article in it. In fact, in the December issue, it's a gorgeous article with color pictures of the galaxy. The article is called Starstruck, that you wrote. And tell us a bit about the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. Most people have never really seen the Milky Way galaxy before, but it's stunning, and it's much bigger and more interesting than we thought, right?
That's right. Most people think the Milky Way is just an average galaxy, but the whole theme of that article in National Geographic is that, in fact, our galaxy is much larger than most other galaxies in the universe. In other words, we inhabit a very above-average galaxy. And this is no coincidence, because it's only the giant galaxies, like the Milky Way, like Andromeda, that are able to create enormous quantities of the heavy elements, like oxygen and iron, that planets need, and that life needs. So it's no coincidence we live in a very large galaxy, a galaxy that is so large that over 24 lesser galaxies revolve around it. They're satellite galaxies of the Milky Way.
And let's talk about the center of our own galaxy. In our own backyard, there is a raging black hole. In fact, in the National Geographic article that you wrote, there's even a two-page spread showing you the center of the Milky Way galaxy, where this black hole rages. How big is that black hole? And some people want to know, how dangerous is it?
Well, let me assure you, it's not dangerous at all, because it's 27,000 light years away. It is the biggest black hole in our galaxy, but as galaxies go, it's actually a rather small black hole. We think that most large galaxies have big black holes at their centers, and ours is actually on the small side. It's about 4 million times the mass of the sun. So that's big. And as I say, it's the biggest in the galaxy, but compared with the black holes at the centers of many other giant galaxies, it's actually on the small side. It's a rather quiet black hole. But every now and then, it does swallow something. And in fact, we actually have been able to deduce some of the past meals that the black hole has eaten, as I point out in the National Geographic article, because when something falls into the black hole, it lets out a stream of X-rays. It gets heated to immense temperatures, and anything that's super, super hot is going to emit X-rays. And we can actually see the glow of X-rays in some of the interstellar clouds surrounding the galactic center. And by sort of extrapolating, by knowing their distance from the black hole, we can figure out when the black hole munched on various things. So, for example, around 1945 or 1950, something like that, the black hole swallowed something that had the mass of a small planet. And in this way, we're able to discover the past activity of that black hole, whose name, by the way, is Sagittarius A star.
So if you want to see a black hole tonight, look in the direction of constellation Sagittarius, though I imagine it's kind of disappointing because it's all covered by dust clouds. But if you were to remove the dust clouds, wouldn't the galactic center be a fireball at night?
It would be very bright because there are so many stars around that black hole. Within just one light year of the black hole, there's over 100,000 stars all caught in the gravitational grip of that black hole. So, yes, it would be a very bright object that you would see. But because there's so much dust in between us and the black hole, you can't see those stars with your eye, and of course you can't see the black hole either.
Now, some people think that the real danger is not to be eaten by a black hole, but to be eaten by our next-door neighbor black hole, Andromeda, which apparently is even bigger than our giant Milky Way galaxy, and it could conceivably eat us up. What are your thoughts?
Well, the Andromeda galaxy is the one galaxy that is larger than us, the one galaxy in the local group that is larger than the Milky Way. And we don't yet know whether the Andromeda galaxy is heading toward us because we don't yet know its sideways motion. We haven't measured that yet. And hopefully in the next 10 or 20 years, we will be able to measure that, and then we'll be able to see whether the two galaxies will eventually collide or whether they're simply dancing around each other in an orbit around each other. But if the two galaxies do collide someday, we're talking, you know, many billions of years from now, no great harm is actually going to come to the stars or the planets in either galaxy. What will happen is the two galaxies will merge, their gas clouds will smash into each other. This will launch an avalanche of new star formation. So the night sky will be very, very brilliant with the birth of lots of new stars throughout this new super galaxy, a combination of Andromeda and the Milky Way. But, you know, we are not going to be harmed at all. We're, you know, the Earth will keep on going around the sun. The sun will keep doing its thing. And, basically life will go on. It's an amazing thing. You see these spectacular Hubble images of colliding galaxies. And yet, with the knowledge that none of the stars, none of the planets are being harmed because the stars are so widely separated from each other, that no two stars are likely to collide. So in other words, no star from Andromeda is likely to, you know, plunge through our solar system and tear the Earth away from the sun. So we're quite safe even if that collision occurs. And as I say, we don't yet know if a collision is in store for the Milky Way and Andromeda.
Now, Andromeda is a beautiful spiral-type galaxy, and we used to think that our galaxy is very similar, like a pinwheel. However, there's another kind of galaxy called barred spiral, where I have a bar, but the bar spins, shooting out stars and creating these spiral arms. So our Milky Way galaxy, is it a normal spiral galaxy like a pinwheel, or is it a barred spiral like a spinning bar?
Well, it's a barred spiral galaxy. That's what we've discovered in the last couple decades. But it's not that big a difference between a normal spiral galaxy. But both types of galaxies, a barred spiral is simply a type of spiral galaxy that has this bar of stars in the middle. And furthermore, probably, you know, bars come and go. So if you were to, you know, come back to the Milky Way in 2 or 3 billion years, you might discover that our galaxy doesn't have a bar anymore. The bar has disappeared, and we're just a normal spiral galaxy. And then if you come back in a few billion years after that, you might discover that the bar has reappeared. So probably spiral galaxies oscillate from being sort of normal spiral galaxies to being barred spiral galaxies. But there's not a real big difference between the two types of galaxies. They're both very beautiful types of galaxies. They're both galaxies that are giving birth to lots of new stars and planets. They rotate very fast. I mean, that's what causes the spiral pattern. Their brightest component, that most of the stars are coming from a very flat disk that, as I say again, is rotating very fast. And so there's much more, there are far more similarities between normal spirals and barred spirals than there are differences. I mean, if you really want to talk about a galaxy that's very different from our galaxy or the Andromeda galaxy, I would point you to a giant elliptical galaxy, such as M87 in the Virgo cluster. That is a galaxy very different from our galaxy. Its stars are all very old. It no longer gives birth to new stars or new planets. It has no clouds of interstellar gas and dust. And it has a black hole at its center that puts ours to shame. Whereas ours is 4 million solar masses, the black hole at the center of M87, this elliptical galaxy in the Virgo cluster, has got 6 billion solar masses of material.
And any parting thoughts that you may have, especially in your article in the National Geographic or any other of the mysteries of our universe? Any parting thoughts?
Well, my parting thought is give thanks to the Milky Way galaxy, because if it weren't so big, we wouldn't be here. It's only the really big galaxies like the Milky Way that are able to produce life. Most of the galaxies in the universe, I believe, are lifeless. They have no life at all. So we're in one of the best galaxies in the universe to live.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on Exploration. Well, that completes our interview with Dr. Ken Croswell, astronomer of Berkeley, but there are two other stories which happened just within the last few days. First of all, the physicists at CERN, outside Geneva, Switzerland, have for the first time in history trapped atoms of antimatter. Now, antiatoms were actually created about 15 years ago, but they vanish as soon as they're created. This time, they were able to make a trap in order to contain 38 atoms of antimatter. Now, if you're a fan of Star Trek, you know that the engines of the Enterprise are energized by antimatter, which is 100% efficient, in fact, 100 times more efficient than a hydrogen bomb. So scientists will wait and see whether or not one day, perhaps decades, maybe centuries into the future, we have enough antimatter to power a starship. Now, if you're a fan of Dan Brown, who wrote Angels and Demons and the Da Vinci Code, you know that the bad guys are able to steal antimatter from CERN, outside Geneva, Switzerland, in order to make an antimatter bomb to blow up the Vatican. Well, there's no danger of that. It turns out that the amount of antimatter needed to blow up an entire city would be, well, a fraction of a teaspoon of antimatter. But even that is beyond our present-day capability. So don't think that anytime soon we're going to be able to create new types of weapons, antimatter bombs, that are 100 times more efficient than ordinary hydrogen bombs. It's simply not possible with today's technology. And in fact, it would bankrupt the United States to create enough antimatter to create an antimatter bomb. So starships also are many decades to centuries in the future. And also, scientists have said that they're looking at a supernova that took place in 1979. And after the star blew up, they're seeing a baby black hole in formation. Now, we've never done that before. We've never actually seen a black hole materialize right before our eyes. And that's what scientists are saying now. So for the first time, we're actually seeing a black hole, an infant black hole, a baby black hole that's in formation. We should also point out that the black hole is about 50 million light years away, too close for us to ever send rockets to reach it. But it does mean that we're able to fill in the missing blanks concerning how stars explode. And then in the remnants of the exploding star, a black hole forms. And the black hole, in turn, is so voracious that it eats up everything in its sight, including entire planets and entire stars. Well, that's it for the first half of Exploration. Once again, our first guest was Dr. Ken Croswell, astronomer of Berkeley. And in the second half, we bring on Dr. Arthur Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're going to be talking about the future of medicine. What about the promise of gene therapy? What about the promise of synthetic life? What about genomics? We'll be talking about all these subjects in the second half of Exploration as we leave outer space and begin to explore inner space. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Dr. Ken Croswell, an astronomer at Berkeley, author of a number of great books on astronomy, such as The Universe at Midnight, Magnificent Mars. Now, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He's the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he'll be talking to us today about the future of medicine. And by the way, if you want to know more about the future of space travel and medicine in book form, get a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Future. It's based on interviews I've conducted with 300 of the world's top scientists. These are experts in medicine, biology, astronomy, geology, computers, telecommunication, robots, you name it. I've interviewed some of the leading scientists concerning the science of the future, and it's all contained in my book, Physics of the Future, which is now a New York Times bestseller. In fact, it hit number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. It's the number 1 science book in the country at the present time. And it even talks about the future of jobs, the future of the economy. I've had a chance to interview some of the leading economists as well. Find out whether your job is doomed for extinction or whether or not your job is going to flourish into the coming years. And so now let's talk to Dr. Arthur Kaplan about the future of medicine. He's at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Kaplan, we've heard about synthetic biology. It sounds, on one hand, very promising. New kinds of therapies may come out of this, new kinds of life forms. But some people say it's kind of ominous because we're playing God in some sense. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, critics or those who have doubts about new technologies often bring out or trot out the playing God objection. But it's interesting. Organized religion, particularly Jewish and Christian, but also Muslim and to some extent Hindu, major religions around the world do not see intervening in nature as somehow immoral or something wrong. That is to say, they understand that there's agriculture, there's medicine, there's engineering. We change the world all the time. We reroute rivers. We plant domesticated crops. We change our animals so that they're making more milk or tastier. And no organized religious group thinks of this as sinful or wrong. I suspect what the objection is saying is it's the playing part. Playfulness, irresponsibility is the techniques of synthetic biology, changing microbes, changing viruses and bacteria to do what we want. Is that being done with adequate responsibility? So I think that's really what the objection and concern is. And I think it can be done with proper oversight, but we have to start talking about that now. Synthetic biology is just in its infancy. We still have time to set up oversight to make sure that agencies are responsible for both the safety of products and that they don't escape and go places we don't want them to be and that there are going to be penalties if they do. So the time for that discussion is now. But in terms of saying, oh, I don't know that we should alter the natural world, I don't think that argument gets us far.
And what about the benefits? The simplest thing would be microbes that can eat oil, preventing gigantic oil spills from polluting the environment. But what are the other benefits?
Well, the oil-eating bacteria certainly is attractive to many. Also, algae, the little green moss-like thing that we see growing in lakes and ponds, it's possible to get that to turn into a fuel maker so that it could make gasoline or methane or other fuels that we could use and thereby reduce the impact of trying to drill for oil, the accidents that we saw with the Chilean miners. So that's obviously very attractive. Synthetic biology also can produce bugs that can step in and help facilitate the processes involved in making things like rubber, which takes 15 or 16 chemical steps to get there. But if you can substitute a bacteria in that can sort of turn one of the key substances and components into something else and skip a couple steps, that really is advantageous. So big companies like Firestone and DuPont that make rubber or polymers keenly interested in synthetic biology. It isn't just to make a bug that somehow is going to crawl out of a lab and get in the water supply and then wind up coming out of your shower head to eat you.
Like,
it's more
like in the movies.
In the industrial sense that synthetic biology has its application.
And some people think that maybe we'll be able to create algae or plants or trees that can gobble up carbon dioxide more efficiently and perhaps do something about global warming. Any thoughts there?
I think that's true, too. I think there are. It's interesting. There are a number of organisms that capture and love carbon dioxide. Plants like it as part of their photosynthesis process. But it turns out that there are a lot of bacteria that have huge appetites for this stuff. And if you could engineer them up, you might find sort of carbon sinks into which you could get rid of a tremendous amount of waste material that now seems to be responsible, at least partly, for heating up the atmosphere. The other option is if you could grow foods using those same microbes, maybe algae that fish could eat, or crabs or shrimp, you could reduce the impact on the environment of fertilizers and sort of heavy pesticide-using practices. So there are many ways in which synthetic biology could turn out to be very environmentally friendly. I suspect it's a technology we do want to push forward.
Okay, let's say a few things about stem cell research, because that's been in the headlines. Under President George W. Bush, there was a restriction on these cells because it involves you destroying embryos. And President Obama seemed to reverse the restrictions on federal funding, but now it's back in the courts.
It is.
What's happening here?
Boy, if I can explain this, I think I should win the award for all-time coherent guest on your program. Very complicated back and forth, but I'll simplify it and say this. Many years ago, probably 10 years ago, Congress passed a bill called the Dickey Amendment, and it prohibited any federal funding of research that involved embryo destruction, human embryo destruction, or anything involving human embryo destruction, cell lines that might have been grown from human embryos that were destroyed. And that bill kept getting passed and passed. At one point, when Obama came in, he said by administrative rule, look, I think the Dickey Amendment doesn't apply. I think we can spend federal funds on certain types of embryonic stem cell research. But opponents basically went to court and said that congressional law does apply. And if Congress had wanted to change it, they would have done something about it. And that's the case that the court has now said can proceed. And I have to say, I have always worried, been very concerned, that that congressional law, which everybody, even President George W. Bush, when he allowed a little bit of stem cell research, everybody was tiptoeing around it, but it's there. It's never been revoked. I think it really is trouble. And, Micho, what really happens is it's not so much who wins or loses in court, but if you tie this up in court and you say you can't spend your grant money, then young researchers are winding up with no funds, and they're going to move on to other things. So it's very damaging to the field, even if they ultimately win this court case. It's not good for the progress of stem cell research in the United States.
And some people are saying there could be a brain drain away from the United States to other countries.
I think that's some risk. I suspect some scientists may wind up going to Singapore or India or Great Britain, where rules are more accepting of embryonic stem cell research. But what I really worry about is that people will just give up on embryonic stem cell research as their area of work and simply do something else. I don't think there'll be a brain drain so much as those brains will get redirected to other topics in biology.
Now, just last month, the FDA gave approval for human trials of a stem cell technology that may one day repair spinal cord injury.
Mm-hmm.
On mice and rats, there seems to be some real progress there using stem cells to repair spinal cord injury. What's the status now, therefore, of trials in the U.S. involving humans?
Well, there is the possibility at all points in the U.S. of doing research with private money. And one of those companies is Geron, and they want to proceed and try the safety study, not so much for a therapy, but a safety trial to put embryonic stem cells into the spinal cord of people who have had their spinal cords damaged or severed, see what happens. It really isn't yet ready for curing anybody. Animal data looks promising, but this will be a first-in-human test. It is now underway. The experiments have started in California. Probably a couple of subjects by now have gotten embryonic stem cells put in, and we're going to have to wait and see. The upside is maybe things will reconnect and they'll get a little bit of sensation in limbs that were basically cut off. Downside, embryonic stem cells could grow out of control, basically causing tumors and put some of these people in life-threatening situations from cancer.
So there is real promise in terms of being able to regrow tissues and organs, but I guess there's also a downside, too, if these things proliferate out of control, right?
Correct. And I think the model that has the most short-term use isn't what they're trying in California. I'm not actually enthusiastic about that study because I think it is risky to put things into the spinal cord. If you look at some of the eye diseases, we have a number of eye diseases like macular degeneration where cells die in the retina of the eye and blindness occurs or visual limits occur. You can do experiments in the eye with embryonic stem cells. They, too, have been promising in dog models, and you can use one eye, use a lot less medicine, and you can get, if you will, in and out of there much more easily than you can the spinal cord. So I think that's where the future is going to be in terms of first human success stories. I don't really think it's going to be the spinal cord model.
So stem cell research in general, though, is a little bit slower than previously thought. Like about, 7, 8 years ago, there was a lot of hype around stem cell research. But I guess it takes time for the technology to mature, right?
It does, and there's another problem. Under the Bush administration, there was no funding, so no federal funds were there. Obama's been around for 2 years. He put a little money in, but the court case occurred. Everything's tied up. So we really have not had public or NIH funding of embryonic stem cell research at all. I always laugh a little when people say, well, I heard a lot about this, but where is it? The fact is there hasn't been a lot of money put into it. There's a little money in Europe. There's a little money in private industry. But the big engine, the NIH, just not a player in this.
Very sad. Now, also, people have responded to advertisements from organizations to read your genes and tell you what kinds of diseases you have and where your ancestors came from. But it sounds a little bit too quick, too fast, right? What are your thoughts about this industry?
I think that's right. I think that we have a situation out there now where lots of companies, as the human genome gets mapped, are rushing out and offering all kinds of tests. I've seen tests on the internet that say, we'll give you a special diet that's compatible with your genes. I've even seen a couple of them say, I can find you a date that's genetically
that right?
compatible. Look, we are just in the infancy stage of where we are with mapping the genome. We've mapped it, and we certainly have found some disease genes, and there are some tests that can be done. But for general use in the population, if you don't have it in your family, if you don't have breast cancer or prostate cancer, you probably aren't yet ready for prime time medical testing. And some of this other stuff about know your ancestry or find out what diet is good for you or what beauty treatments will help you, that really is off the mark in terms of where the science is. So I'm a proponent of genetic testing, and I think it's coming and it will be very, very useful. Actually, Michio, I think where we're going to see it used more is not so much in who's at risk of diseases, but probably to monitor our medicines to figure out why some people have bad side effects and other people respond well to drugs. That's clearly biological. I think you'll be able to test people for the way they metabolize different drugs or use, burn up different drugs. And I think that's where the future is here. The risk stuff, kind of interesting. But I think at the end of the day, we don't even have much evidence that if I told you that you were at risk of something and you should change your lifestyle to handle it, that you're going to do it. You know, we can do it now with weight, with exercise, and I don't see people flocking to make lifestyle changes.
Well, for BBC television, I actually had my genes read,
not all of them,
but they sent my blood to Vanderbilt University and had many of my genes sequenced. However, that's a reputable organization. However, if you send your genes to maybe three or four of these companies,
yeah.
Is there any consistency or they just make up these numbers?
There is no consistency. Anybody can open a lab and say, I'm going to be a gene analyzer, and they do. And so while there are certainly some certified labs, as we like to say, the standards for the field haven't really been put in place yet. So I would tell you, if it's on the internet, I wouldn't be too trusting of it yet.
So there's no real regulation of this technology then?
There really isn't. For a while, some of the companies stayed away from regulation by saying they weren't giving medical advice. They were just giving you personal information kind of for fun, ancestry or things to know about yourself. Only this year did the FDA say, look, some of these claims are clearly medical claims, telling someone they can manage their medicines differently or are going to have risk of certain disease, and we're going to step in and start to regulate. But it was only this year, just within the past few months, that that happened.
Okay. And also, for people who've been reading the newspapers, there seems to be a rather unusual number of drug recalls, which are very expensive, involving lawsuits, claims of injury. Why do we have this rash of drug recalls?
That's a great question. I think it's telling us something very important. We have had close oversight and pretty tough regulation of drug development in the United States. The FDA really takes this very seriously. You have to show safety of drugs in animals first, then you carefully try them out in people in low doses, then in bigger doses. And it's only when you get to the end of that process that you can try them out in doses that you think are going to work to affect the disease after you've established the safety of the drug. So it basically has to go through a five-step process. But by putting so much regulation there, we don't follow closely what's happening in the real world. And here's what I mean. When we do studies, you tell someone, look, you have diabetes. To be in my study, you're going to take this medicine. But I also want you to control your diet, not take any other medicines, don't take any alternative or complementary medicine. I want you to be here every week, and you're going to take the exact dose on time. It's a very restricted world in which you set up ideal conditions. Now, what happens in the real world? You decide to skip your medicine because you feel pretty good. One day you say, oh, well, I missed it last time. I'll take it in a double dose. Oh, here's somebody offering me a cure that they heard about at the gym. They say it's good for diabetes. I'll take that too. All kinds of drug interactions, non-compliant behavior. So we're testing for an ideal world, but the reality is patients are pretty complicated. They don't always do what they're told, and that can lead to trouble when you get out in the real world. So I think the recalls in part are due to too much emphasis on idealized testing. Not enough oversight of what's really taking place, real people acting in real ways.
Uh-huh. Now, also, about 5-10 years ago, there was a lot of hype around gene therapy. We thought we'd be able to fix damaged genes because all of us have some genetic predisposition towards mm-hmm. certain diseases.
It turns out that everyone is mortal.
Right.
Something will come.
That's right. However, we haven't heard anything recently, just a little bit of victory here or there. What's the latest in terms of gene therapy?
Gene therapy involves trying to trick viruses primarily into carrying information into our cells, delivering genetic repair kits. You sort of fool the virus, which normally goes in there to reproduce itself, into bringing a message that you want it to deliver to someone who has a genetic defect or an error. So you're trying to use it as a repair kit. It turned out to be tricky to get the right viruses. That's what's held up gene therapy. Some people are allergic to certain things we put in them, and so that's been trouble. Sometimes they shoot the virus shoots the genes in, but it doesn't put them in the right place. That either means nothing happens or something bad happens. So we've had to basically get our arrows have had to become more precise to deliver the genetic information. Now, where we are is we went back to animals, and there is good work in mice and rats testing these viruses, or as they're sometimes called, vectors, to make them much more precise and much more controllable. And I do think you're going to hear more about gene therapy in the next few years as these models come out of the animal work. We were basically using shotguns when gene therapy started, not precise enough. you need a sniper rifle.
Uh-huh. And last question about the aging process. There's been some headway, a lot of hype, of course. Some people are talking about resveratrol, a drug that is found in red wine, and also genes like SIRT2. Other people say that it's a lot of hype and there's nothing reproducible in the laboratory. What's the state of aging research?
Well, aging research is chugging along. We didn't really know much about why we aged for a long, long time. Starting to learn some factors about how cells divide and what their limits are and how many times they can divide, which is clearly associated with aging. If you have a cell that can only divide 10, 12, or 14 times and that's it, that means you're out of it. You can't repair yourself. I think some of the chemicals like resveratrol are promising. They're interesting ideas. I wouldn't unleash my complete collection of red wine every evening, but I think we're starting to learn that there's some medicinal benefit to that glass of red wine or grape juice if you're not so inclined to the alcohol. But overall, what we've really learned is this, and it's pretty simple. Being overweight, getting enough exercise, not being a couch potato, and making sure that you avoid the sun, wear your sunscreen. There are some very simple things we can do to extend our lives. They are not as glamorous as some of the fights about, you know, this drug or that drug or this bit of medicinal wisdom from some culture. But those simple steps play key roles in a longer life. Diet, exercise, trying to control exposure to known carcinogens, smoking, the sun, that sort of thing. So we know already some tricks. The challenge is to do them.
Okay, so in some sense, maybe we have a little bit of the fountain of youth in exercise and good diet. Okay, well, thank you so much for being on Exploration.
Thank you.
And that completes our interview with Dr. Arthur Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and one of the nation's leading bioethicists. Well, in the last few minutes of Exploration, let me summarize some of the other top stories in medicine. One story comes from genomics. Did you know that in the future, you'll probably have a CD-ROM with literally every single gene in your body listed? At the present time, today, it costs about $50,000 in order to have every single gene in your body sequenced. Too much for the average person, but that's today. Given the fact that computer power doubles every 18 months, we expect that in the coming years it should drop to $1,000 and maybe just a few hundred dollars after that. So in other words, in the future, when you go to the doctor's office, you'll have a CD-ROM, which is your owner's manual. You realize that in your living room, you have an owner's manual for your VCR, your Blu-ray, your television set, your flat screen, and your MP3. You have literally owner's manuals for everything in your living room, except the most important thing of all. You. You have no owner's manual. Well, we'll have that. And not only will the owner's manual tell you your predisposition for breast cancer, for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and a host of other diseases, not only will your doctor then begin to prescribe certain therapies and medicines on the basis of that, but this CD-ROM will also be able to trace your ancestry going back 10, 20,000 years. By getting a match of other individuals who have similar genes, you can then begin to trace the ancestral path that your mother's mother's mother or father's father's father took perhaps thousands of years ago. In fact, I had my genes read by Vanderbilt University for BBC television for a documentary that I hosted for BBC. They sequenced many of my genes, and yes, you could see in my correlation where my ancestors came from tens of thousands of years ago. Also, high blood pressure is in the news. It turns out that 75 million Americans, in fact, 1 billion people worldwide, have high blood pressure, which in turn is linked to strokes and deterioration of your cardiovascular system. Many people who have high blood pressure, For example, African Americans have a hard time bringing their blood pressure down. Some people have to take 3 or 4 drugs to control their high blood pressure. And here's a new therapy that was just announced last week. And that is using radio waves. Radio waves to deaden some of the nerves near the kidney. And that allows the body then to bring down high blood pressure. So this is a therapy that we're going to watch very carefully. It turns out that of the people that had this radio wave that was shot into their kidneys, they experienced a marked decrease in their high blood pressure. And that in turn could help to one day reduce the rate of strokes and heart attacks. And also, speaking about the cardiovascular system, many people are on different kinds of cholesterol medicines, but a new one is coming that will literally blow the competition right out of the water. It turns out this new drug being developed by Merck has the ability to have dramatic lowering of the bad cholesterol and a dramatic raising of the high cholesterol. It turns out that LDL scores, that is the bad cholesterol, levels drop from 81 to 45. This is amazing. And the good cholesterol rose from 41 to a whopping 101. Now, of course, perhaps the best way to control cholesterol is through diet and eating the right foods and cutting back on animal fats and getting good exercise. However, it doesn't hurt to think about what it would take to lower the bad cholesterol and raise the high cholesterol, good cholesterol. It turns out that Merck is now asking the Food and Drug Administration to begin trials of this wonder drug that could literally change the whole landscape with respect to cholesterol. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first special guest was Dr. Ken Croswell, astronomer of Berkeley. And our second special guest was Dr. Arthur Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, urging you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.